This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Cowie. I'm the Dean of the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at UC San Diego. And we are just delighted to be able to host this program today. We're delighted both because of our distinguished guest and his interlocutor, one of our dear friends and most distinguished members of the faculty, but also because it's always great to welcome back a former student. And memories of Kurt Campbell are still strong with both Susan and me from his years as an undergraduate, although overshadowed by our work with him as a colleague in government over the years as well. So let me do a brief introduction. This is a program that is being organized underneath the 21st Century China program of the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies and UC San Diego. And in this program, one of our objectives is to bring together leadership from all parts of the world to discuss this crucial intersection between China, the United States, and the emerging world of the 21st century. We're very fortunate today to be able, at a moment when the presidents of China and the United States are meeting in an important get-together, to bring together one of the people responsible for the pivot towards Asia in the Obama administration, and one of the architects of China policy in the Clinton administration, for a discussion. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to the expert hands of Susan, and I'm sure that we're in for a very special moment.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks to all of you for coming. It's wonderful that Kurt Campbell, who graduated from UCSD in 1980, and did take some political science courses, including one with me on China, but he always teases me that I actually have no memory of him at all, even though he was a very outstanding student. And he actually studied Russia more here at UCSD and spent time abroad in the Soviet Union, and has... He's held so many important positions in government. Some people call him the most valuable player in U.S. foreign policy because he's been at the Joint Chiefs, he's been at the White House National Security Council, he's been in the Treasury Department, he's been at the Pentagon, which is when we worked together in the Clinton administration, and most recently, he really is the architect of the Obama administration, very successful policy of paying more attention to Asia. So let's start by talking about that policy, Kurt, unless you want to make any preliminary remarks.
Can I just say, first of all, thank you all for coming today. It's great to see you, and I want to thank Professor Shirk and Professor Cowie, Dean Cowie, when I was a student here. When I hear all the nice comments, it makes me wish I'd actually studied a little bit more when I was here. I spent more time doing what I did this morning, which was swimming and surfing, than I actually did studying, but still it's great to be back here, and I can't tell you how much this experience has meant to me and how great it is to see what's taken place since. I'm a huge supporter of the school. In my view, it is the only school of its kind that is really aimed at the principal challenges of the 21st century, which is building stronger links not only between the United States and China, but Asia as a whole. And I'll be doing what I can to help in that endeavor going forward. Let me just say that one of the interesting things about the words, or the words that one describes for this period of time when the United States has been at least more focused on the Asia-Pacific region than we have been for a significant period. Let's all recall that it was meant to be the case that the 21st century was going to be the Asia-Pacific century, and we have basically, for the first 10 or 15 years, been on a dramatic detour from that, just incredible focus on the Middle East and South Asia, and extremely expensive commitments in terms of blood and treasure and the like, and prestige, some would argue. I think we attempted in the administration to articulate a game plan for more focus on the Asia-Pacific region, which was primarily based on a diplomatic approach that would have several components: strong central engagement with our allies, a recognition of a deep need for the United States and China to work together for peace and stability in the 21st century, a United States that was prepared to join the emerging architecture of the Asia-Pacific region, the East Asia Summit, the ASEAN Regional Forum, to again embrace the economic and trade components of our Asia strategy. Asians looked to the United States to be open and optimistic, and I think there was a period that the United States shrank a little bit from some of the challenges and opportunities of the Asia-Pacific region. So the idea was to articulate an integrated approach across the board that would recognize directly and appropriately that the lion's share of the history of the 21st century, Susan, would be written in Asia. Now, this piece was primarily articulated in a piece written by Secretary Clinton in Foreign Policy about 3 years ago. For those of you who have not worked in government, 99 times out of 100, you come up with a big idea, you introduce it, and it just disappears as quickly as you can imagine. Poof, you know, just gone, and you feel terrible that, you know, all the hard work, and you don't get very much coverage, right? That's mostly how government works. There is the very rare occasion where you just find that moment where what you've done just basically explodes, takes off, you know, has an enormous amount of attention, more than you would have ever imagined. And then you're dealing with a very different set of challenges, which are not the challenges of being ignored and feeling short shrifted and unhappy about the lack of attention. Instead, you're dealing with a circumstance where you have to deal with the unintended consequences of the piece or the argument that you've put forward. And that was, and that has been, frankly, our legacy. When we wrote this piece, and I worked very closely with the Secretary, there are three of us, her wonderful head of policy planning, Jake Sullivan, myself, and the Secretary. When we wrote it, there was only a passing reference to a term, pivot. And for a variety of reasons, the editors of the Foreign Policy magazine decided to put that term in the title, right? And then that became part of this almost deep central debate about whether we like the term rebalance or we like the term pivot. And so it's almost a diplomatic or strategic Rorschach test, like which term do you use, what does that mean? How are you positioning yourselves in the debate? Now, I will just say on the record, I think rebalancing is a better term, frankly. But I am deeply and closely associated with the concept of the term pivot. The problem with the language, in my view, is that it struck a lot of nerves, some of which, again, as I indicated, were unintentional. One was the idea that we were going to move away dramatically from our European allies, right? If you look at American foreign policy, everything that the United States has ever done of significance over 50 to 75 years, we have done with Europe, right? Whether it's wars or comprehensive challenges like the Balkans or climate change. And I would argue that one of the few areas that we really need to expend more focus on in terms of expanding our partnership is on Asia, because Europe understands as well that Asia will be about the 21st century. And so I think, Susan, the unintended message that we were turning away was deeply unfortunate. I think the other fact is that it made people believe that we would potentially cut and run in the Middle East and South Asia, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that is not in our strategic interests, right? It sends a bad message to Asians, both in terms of our capabilities and our potential staying power and how much we can be relied upon by our central allies. But it's not just that. One of the great successes of the Bush administration, frankly, was getting Asians engaged in what we might call out-of-area pursuits. The country that's most committed to civil society in Afghanistan and Pakistan is probably not the United States. It's probably Japan. South Korea deeply involved in some of the things that we've done in the Middle East and South Asia. And so the two unintended messages, I think, were worrisome. I think the other thing that has also been discussed is somehow the word pivot suggested to some a strategy of containment, right? And as much as we tried hard to explain, look, at the center of our strategy is a desire to work closely with China to figure out how we can make clear that a degree of partnership, even with the tensions, is essential for the 21st century. But I think a number of things conspired, one of which was the concept. Another, frankly, I think wishfully, perhaps quietly, some Chinese friends hoped and believed that the United States was in the midst of a decline and we would be out of Asia relatively quickly. And so this, on some level, was unwelcome. To the point that, guys, that I think, you know, the question of which word you use for a while was quite closely watched and followed inside my own government. So I will tell you that after all of us were strongly encouraged to use the word rebalance, so most of us at the State Department did, but we only to find that after a while that the only person who really liked the term pivot was President Obama. So it was very awkward, and I found myself, I'll just turn back over to Susan here. I have a young daughter who's 5. This is a true story about a month and a half ago. She, you know, they take ballet, all kids that age take a little ballet course, and so she's in her little pink tutu, and her teacher, lovely college woman, very teaching all these young kids to dance, and so she's basically, and I'm sitting waiting for, you know, her to leave, and so the teacher is telling the girls, now girls, pivot, 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 and the more she's saying pivot, the more uncomfortable I'm getting, and I'm saying, don't you mean rebalance? Shouldn't they rebalance? So.
That's great. Well, don't you think that one reason that the initiative really took off is because of the way China started behaving? So that after more than a decade of very successful, flexible, accommodating policy toward its neighbors, starting around the time of the Olympics, after the Olympics, you know, China, I think, made a number of serious mistakes in the way it started behaving toward its neighbors. Previously, it had not acted like a bully. But in the South China Sea, with South Korea, Korean Peninsula, you know, there was a shift. There was a change. And this suddenly led a lot of Asian countries to start running to the U.S. corner. And I think, do you think that in a way that was, I suppose, a good thing in terms of support for the U.S., but it's not a good thing in that it kind of leads to two hostile blocs in the region?
Well, Susan, I realize you're asking the question in a way to try to get me to kind of think about it strategically, not to be provocative, but my experience of Asia is a little different. I don't find that there's any country in Asia, any country that says, aha, I'm going to be on the American team versus the China team, or I'm going to shift my emphasis. I mean, it's an important thing for Americans to understand. What Asian countries want is a very delicate balance in which they have the opportunity to trade and work with China, but they also want a good relationship with the United States. Every country in Asia, including the United States, wants a better relationship with China. And so I don't believe that there is a sense of wanting to, quote, side with the United States. But I do think what people wanted to send a message on a careful set of issues, like territorial issues, is that these matters have to be handled more carefully. And in that respect, I think many Asian countries sided with a very broad number of countries, including the United States, in sending what we thought was a subtle message about the need for an effective management on the most difficult issues in Asia, which are these territorial issues, which really can't easily be resolved in any set of circumstances. They are best exported more into the future as we go forward. I do think, though, Susan, you put your finger on something that frankly, it's great that we have programs here like at UCSD to help explore more deeply. I think you could make a strategic case that from about 2007 to about 2009, there was an arrival dramatically in China of a new perspective on global politics, which basically superseded the, like, if you think there are basically three schools of thought broadly engineered about China's role in the world. The first really was the traditional Biden-Hyde school, and I know people don't like that term, but it basically is about tactics and about gaining more power. And it was a big tent, bringing in both some liberals and conservatives. Swallow your bitterness, keep fighting, your time will come in the future. And that has been a very effective sort of framing reference for Chinese foreign policy. During the period where Susan and I worked together the most in the 1990s, it was the high water mark of a second school, which basically was a group of academics, mostly in Beijing and Shanghai, that argued that it was possible for the United States and China to work together, and that for true peace and stability, a degree of cooperation, not so much G2, but just strategic understanding and cooperation, was both possible and should be aimed for. And the interesting thing about that group is that the writers that have been affiliated and associated with that group still exist, but they don't write on this subject very much anymore. In fact, very little, per se. They write about distrust or what are the problems that exist, but they don't advocate as much for this position as they have in the past. But what we really saw was the arrival of what might be described a third school, which basically said, look, our time has come. We are the victors. We are the ones that prevailed during the global economic crisis. And the United States is weak, and they've contained us, and we now have to stand up and take a much stronger line. During that period, there probably were some steps in Chinese foreign policy that, on reflection, particularly in Southeast Asia, that Chinese friends would probably reevaluate and take a different stance now. But I think the key issue is going to be what to expect going forward from Xi Jinping and key interlocutors, particularly on Asia strategy. I think what we have seen to date, Susan, suggests that there will be a more differentiated approach. Some countries will get very close engagement, and others will be treated with some distance and perhaps a little disdain. There is a lot of anxiety quietly in Asia about maps, about certain, you know, deployments and the like. And I think that's something that Chinese friends have to be careful about. Just one last point, though, that I will say. What was interesting to me in the aftermath of what was called the South China Sea Initiative, in which a group of nations in 2010 at the ASEAN Regional Forum basically made an argument about how these issues had to be handled, I think Chinese friends, even very senior friends in the foreign ministry and elsewhere, their response was one of being deeply hurt, like we've done so much for you all in Southeast Asia and you are so ungrateful. And so I think that aspect of Chinese foreign policy is actually still prevalent. There is a sense of being betrayed almost by some of these countries. And I think, in a sense, what China is starting to understand is that as great it is to be a great power, there are a lot of challenges that come with it. And I'm not sure. I think China has been very much hopeful and looking forward to the positive aspects of what it is to be a great power. But I think in all likelihood, the next 10 to 15 years will be learning some of the lessons that countries like Great Britain before, the United States now, is that it's not all that fun sometimes to be a great power.
And I think China has always worried that given its historical role in the region, that other countries would, smaller countries would gang up and point fingers at China and blame China for the problems in the region. And that that's the way they felt in Hanoi, I think, at the ASEAN Regional Forum. So is there anything, including that effort to raise, to get the Chinese to go back to discussing a code of conduct in the South China Sea at that meeting in Hanoi, or other landmark events in the carrying out of the rebalancing pivot that you would do any differently, that you think you maybe should have been a little more nuanced or...
I think we could have done a much better job of explaining what it is, what were the, like, you know, we tried to write articles, tried to give speeches, tried to integrate carefully, but the truth is there, you know, that you learn wonderful things about politics. One of the great lines of Richard Nixon when he was president or was campaigning, saying just when you're sick and tired of saying something, the people are hearing it for the first time. We could have been, I think, more effective at communicating what our primary goals were and, frankly, desire to work closely with China as well as other countries. I think the real key to this rebalancing or pivot is at its core to embed China in a larger regional strategy, right? And then to recognize that you cannot do Asia policy through a G2, right? Because that just makes everyone anxious and uncertain. What you really need is a regional strategy based on close work with your allies, work in a multilateral framework with countries as part of defining architecture for the 21st century, and a recognition of needing a deep cooperative relationship with China. So I think that's the key. That to do that effectively, though, is hard. It's time-consuming. It requires, frankly, a very thorough strategic understanding, and it requires a degree of perseverance that is not for the faint-hearted. I was telling an earlier group, so I was in my job for a little over 4 years. I traveled to Asia 79 times during that period. That's a lot of, that's hard. That's a brutal, but that's what's necessary when you're involved in this kind of endeavor.
So let's talk about the maritime issues a little bit. They've really been the most delicate and the most contentious. And, of course, China's relations with Japan are always fraught because of history and maybe because of a certain competition between what are really two rising powers. In fact, we see after a period of being in the doldrums, you know, things are picking up in Japan again. And but in Southeast Asia as well, and even with including Korea. So how do you feel about where the U.S. is in handling those maritime issues? Are you comfortable with our position, which is basically that we don't take a position on sovereignty, but we don't like the idea of using coercion to settle them?
Yeah. Thanks, Susan. First of all, let me just say that these are, like I've been involved in almost every kind of diplomatic encounter in the last, dissidents, issues associated with, you know, nuclear issues, proliferation, you name it. By orders of magnitude, these are the most difficult issues. Like, you can see across the table that your counterpart literally has white knuckles dealing with this issue. It's one of the few times that you will quietly deal with your counterpart and he or she will say, I have no flexibility on this issue. My instructions are without any, you know, flexibility whatsoever. So it's very hard to underestimate how serious these issues are. I would also simply say that they're not new. They've been around for a long period of time, some for hundreds of years, some essentially since the end of the Second World War. We have experienced enormous progress and growth during a period in which these issues are present. But we have managed to look over them, to find a context where you put them aside. And I think the general approach, which is that the time's not ripe to try to resolve them fundamentally, has generally been the right approach. So I will say that generally. I think a second issue here, Susan, is that it is the case, there probably have been some examples in areas of Chinese actions that are perceived to be provocative, but China is not alone. Frankly, there are a number of countries in Asia overfishing or issues associated with prospecting for hydrocarbons have taken steps that have triggered tensions. So this is not a China-specific issue. This is an Asian-wide issue more generally, and you see that playing out in almost every set of circumstances. Third, it's not just about China, as we've discussed. You have problems between Japan and Russia that are longstanding, between Japan and South Korea, the Liancourt Warrocks, a number of issues in Southeast Asia. Remember, some of the most difficult and problematic issues associated with uncertainties over territory have involved Malaysia, which has been very quiet behind the scenes, but lots of fishing and other issues in the past. Right now, I think the United States has done what it can in a variety of circumstances, quite honestly, with very limited and mixed results. On the one hand, we have almost always encouraged cooler heads to prevail, tried to help open lines of communication. Sometimes we've been successful. We've occasionally sent unofficial envoys in to do diplomacy to try to explain what our position is and how these issues have to be handled carefully and peacefully. As Susan indicated, we have a general framework which we apply, which is peaceful resolution of disputes, legal framework, and the like. We've added a few wrinkles, and we hope some of this will help in a difficult set of circumstances. One of the things that we think is positive that we are in the midst of is that there are a number of very important high-level conversations that are ongoing between claimant states about how to potentially extrapolate and explore hydrocarbon and other resources in situations in which sovereignty is not fully established, right? So that would mean two states, for instance, the Philippines and China, might be able to come to terms about how to creatively go after a joint production, but not agree to ultimate sovereignty. The problem is that any official who's involved in these set of circumstances in any country feels immediately at very real levels of tension because of uncertainty about how any agreement would be treated at home. And we see that basically on a regular basis. My own personal view is that we have a degree of commonality now in ASEAN about issues associated with the South China Sea. And here, I would say the United States has tried to be very, very careful. In truth, it is very hard to establish by any means the claims that China has established for the South China Sea. They are beyond any legal framework that anyone could come up with. However, people are very careful not to say that publicly. Instead, they have tried to say, look, let's establish a process based on some of the parameters associated with the law of the sea and other international code that will allow for a process of diplomacy. I think that process will play out over time. I do not believe we will come to any resolutions, but it's possible that you can carefully get various countries to back off. And again, Susan, as we said earlier, find some creative solutions. It is the issue between Japan and China that I'm most worried about. And I will tell you, there is an irony of leaving government, right? So I've been now to Japan and China a couple of times in the last couple of months. Because I was an assistant secretary, there's only so high you can meet in government. You can't meet at the highest levels because of protocol reasons. But once you leave government, sometimes governments want to talk with you at higher levels. And so, ironically, I've had more higher level conversations since I left government than when I was in, when now I'm just, kind of a nobody on the street. So I have been struck in my conversations, Susan, in both China and Japan about these islands. They're rocks, basically, in the middle of the sea. The Chinese call them the Diaoyutai, and the Japanese call them the Senkakus. I've been struck at how much mirror imaging there is on both sides, with the Chinese and Japanese each saying, we have clearly the right position, and we have got these guys on the run and a little bit more pressure, and they're going to fold. And neither side is going to fold. And we are seeing on a daily basis military and other operations that I think the chance for miscalculation is remarkably high. And we have two countries, one country, Japan, that has not fought and not fired a shot in anger in 70 years. So a lot of uncertainty be what would happen if this something like this occurred. In China, in which there is a very delicate balance between party and military relations, and the so-called rules of engagement that have been propagated in these circumstances are often very vague. And so you've got people operating basically around the clock in close proximity, in high degree of tensions, with huge nationalistic fervor. And so, if this continues for very much longer, 6 months, a year or so, I think the chance of an accident are high. And I think an accident involving China and Japan right now could have completely unexpected and extremely dangerous implications for all. And people do not recognize, really, that with slow growth in Europe and still challenges in the United States, the cockpit of the global economy is in Northeast Asia. And everything that we have seen, basically the remarkable progress of the last 40 years, is essentially based in one way or another on Japan and China working together. And if that comes apart, the consequences, not just for these two nations, but for the world, will be deep and profound.
Yeah, and the whole future of the region really does depend on China-Japan relations, don't you think?
I do, and I have to say, I have been troubled by the language that I've heard in both countries in recent months.
Yeah, I was just reading some things that Abe had said, which sounded very similar to the things that Xi Jinping has been saying about sort of national revival, which can be positive, but it can also be framed as, we're going to best China, or in China's case, we're going to best Japan or best the United States.
Look, I think a little of this national revival is...
It's fine.
Yeah. I think the problem I see are different kinds of discussions. In China, I have heard discussions about Japan that are deeply regrettable and antithetical to, frankly, anything that I'd like to see with respect to the relationship between two countries. But in Japan, I've also heard some discussions that I think are inappropriate about China, and obviously we've had some discussions of history which are just contrary to the kind of atmosphere that we seek in the Asia-Pacific region. And so I'm afraid that these environments, this context, allows for certain almost jingoistic, expressions that are just not healthy.
I was recently in Berlin for the Trilateral Commission. There were lots of Japanese there. And, in Berlin, you're just, you see on every block how thoroughly the Germans have digested and pondered their experience in World War II and the treatment of Jews and other groups and the camps and everything, and the education that every school child goes through. So I must say I made myself pretty obnoxious with all my Japanese friends, because I said, you know, especially now that we see Japan's economy reviving, this is a great moment of opportunity for Japan in the region too. But without that kind of domestic educational effort, it's just hard to see how Japan can play the kind of leadership role in the region that it should be playing.
Yeah, look, I probably have a subtly less ambitious objective in the current context, which is just to stop talking about it. Like, I think at a certain level that, you know, history is going to be better left to the historians. And that the more that political leaders start talking about what is, quote, unquote, a comfort woman or what happened in a city, I think there is the almost inevitable consequence that tensions go up and anger rises. Like, I've now been in meetings just in the last couple of months where very reputable, extremely long friendships between Japanese and Koreans, between Japanese and Chinese, and other countries have just been thoroughly tested by a statement or a comment. And I can't begin to underscore how important it is to just change the subject for a period of time.
I certainly agree diplomatically, but I still believe that domestically it would be important for Japan to educate people more about their wartime experience. And of course, China has its own history issues as well. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. I know that one experience you've had that has been really exciting is the opening up of Myanmar. So why don't you tell us about Aung San Suu Kyi and, you know, your experience with that?
Well, I was part of the effort. You know, American foreign policy in Burma or in Myanmar has essentially failed for 30 years. We've had remarkably little contact with the government. And Secretary Clinton basically championed a study in which we would figure out what was the best way forward. And so after a fairly intensive review and discussion with some key players on Capitol Hill, and remember that our Burma policy in many respects was almost fully articulated and run by the legislative branch as opposed to the executive branch. Very strong advocates of how we would handle things. But finally, we got the go-ahead to start a process of dialogue with the junta, the previous government, about the way forward. And frankly, nothing in my experience prepared me for the progress that we have made, and I think we will continue to make. So over a period of about a year and a half, I had about 20 or 25 secret meetings with elements within the government, and always careful, very much behind the scenes, which seemed to be, frankly, not making very much progress. We laid down some very clear parameters.
So did you change? I mean, it's kind of a mystery,
yeah,
or a puzzle why they decided to do this. So
we put some things on the table that we would be prepared to do. We were much more specific about the carrots involved. I think also we tried to articulate a worldview in which the longer they were proceeding on this course, the more backward, the more behind, the more reliant they would be on just a couple of nations, and that their interests were to diversify and that they would have a lot of support if they took those steps. I can't say that it wasn't clear at the time where any of these conversations really had an impact, but you started to sense at times that we were getting through. I'll just give you one example. So on my second visit, which was, public visit, I flew into both Rangoon, Yangon, and Naypyidaw, the secretive capital that's built by the generals in the middle part of the country. So we negotiated hard, and this is a period before Aung San Suu Kyi had been released, and so they gave us 3 hours with her in a private house that she would be escorted from, driven from her home to this Russian hotel on a lake, this old sort of Russian-era hotel. And I'll never forget, so we drove up, I had a couple of colleagues with me, and the word had spread that she was going to be let out, and suddenly over the hills, just hundreds, thousands of people were waiting just to see a glimpse of her. And I'll never forget, so I'm waiting, a small car just came up with the windows darkened and the door opened, and there out of the car stepped Aung San Suu Kyi just to meet with me. And I remember thinking to myself, like if you want to hear something just completely, unimpressive, like I remember thinking as she walked out of the car, hey, that's Aung San Suu Kyi. and like I knew I was going to be meeting her, but it was just this incredible, there she just stood out of the car. And so we went in, and it was the most interesting dialogue I've ever had with another person, frankly. So she walked in, she had a very clear sense. We had 3 hours, we set the clock, very disciplined, what topics we were going to touch on at what time and how we were going to go through it. So we spent the first hour talking about why the leadership might be interested in reform and opening up to the United States. So she had a theory that it would happen, why it would happen, and we went through it in great detail. And she had her theory. I prepared a little bit, so I had a number of views myself. I think the biggest reason, frankly, is not the China dimension or a lot of the things that have been discussed, but actually the personality of one person who's received remarkably little credit in all of this, and that's the president, Thein Sein. Very mild-mannered, very technocratic general. He was the unified choice to be the leader of the new country. He, quote-unquote, won the election. But he was number five in the previous hierarchy of the nine generals who ran the country basically for the last 25 years. I had met with him extensively. He had been one of my interlocutors. And I was always struck he was so different than the other generals who were tough and hard men. He was a very soft-spoken, careful guy. And he, as his role in the previous government, he was prime minister. And so what that meant is he traveled around Asia a lot, Susan, in meetings. And see, if you were representing Burma or Myanmar in the past, there you had very little to do. People didn't treat you very well. And so he would have a couple of meetings, but then would spend his time walking around cities. He liked to go to schools. And so I think it became painfully clear to him how far behind Myanmar had fallen.
Well, it's like the Chinese in the 70s.
Exactly, Susan.
Or what we would like to get the North Koreans to come
exactly.
out, too.
The fact is the North Koreans, the more they do it, the more it causes them to be anxious about reform, but we'll talk about that later. So basically, he saw what was happening. And remember, 50 years ago, the most developed country in Southeast Asia, by orders of magnitude, was Burma. And, I mean, just so you all know about the terminology Burma and Myanmar, this is one of the great things about British imperialism. The difference in the words, right? So the first generation of British diplomats, when they met the Burmese and they were talking and they asked, how do you call your country? What do you call your country? They were saying Myanmar, but somehow the British heard Burma. And so that is actually the difference between the language. And so it is not a politically incorrect usage. Most Burmese inside the country, when they are writing the country, write Myanmar. Right?
They want to use Myanmar now.
Most Myanmarese believe that that is a better
right.
use of time. Remember, Burma is one ethnic group within
right.
a larger country. So we could go into that. But basically, he, more than anyone else, understood the need to reform He's a very modest man, and we had encouraged again and again, reach out to Aung San Suu Kyi, sit with her, you will be impressed by her. And suddenly, after months of work, we learned through a variety of channels that he had welcomed her into his house. And he, unlike other generals, lives very modestly. And so she came into his small house, and his wife had personally made a dinner for the three of them. And then over the table of the small, intimate dining room that had been set for them was a picture of her father, who was the father of the nation, who was the man who mentored the president when he was a young military officer. And together, tentatively, carefully, they began to talk about their hopes and dreams for the country. Now, it's not an easy partnership, and there's lots of challenges, but this partnership between the two most unlikely of people, right? A former brutal military leader and a global democratic icon, each of whom are shedding clothes in a way, right? He is taking off the army fatigues that he wore for most of his career, and she is shedding the garments of being a global icon and is now a politician. And that's a hard mission, right? So I have to say, it's an incredible thing. I'm very proud of this. And it was hard. And, you know, what you learn in these jobs is, you know, I was telling someone earlier what it's like to work at the State Department. It's a weak institution, but you have to use all your cunning, all your guile, all your strategy, everything you can to create leverage and influence. And this is one of the cases where we won out. So we got Secretary Clinton to go last year. A wonderful surprise visit, went incredibly well. And I was with President Obama in December when he made his visit to Myanmar, to Burma. I will tell you one last funny story on this. So we, Secretary Clinton and I, a couple of our the aides, got on Air Force One. So we flew from Thailand in to Yangon. Incredibly exciting. So we briefed the president and, you know, real sense of one team. And, you know, really, remember, you know, we had this idea of unclenched fist. This is the only time that it had worked. And so we had delivered it. And it was just a wonderfully exciting experience. And, you know, it was just terrific. So we landed, and I saw one of the dear, dear friends of ours is the ambassador to Burma from the United States. I helped in getting that job. It's just a great thing. And so we landed, and what happens when you land is that, you know, in a presidential trip, there are about 100 cars, right? And you better get to your car before the president leaves or you are screwed. So you've got to get to your car in the motorcade. And so I was in car 900, I think. Man. So it might as well have been in Thailand. And so the plane landed, and I mean, we're running full speed, and so I'm basically running to get into my car. And I noticed that two Secret Service guys are following me and kind of running behind me, and I'm kind of speeding up, and they're coming behind me. And when I was on the airplane, I may have actually stolen everything I possibly could that had a White House emblem on it. So every piece of paper, seat assignment. So I had tons of stuff, the truth, that I had stolen off the plane, probably 1,000 things, okay? And so I'm thinking these guys are coming to arrest me. I'm not making this up, and I'm throwing it out as I'm running down kind of serpentine down the runway to get to my car. And finally, one of the super secret service guys goes, Dr. Campbell, and I'm literally ready to like turn myself in. I'm sorry, I thought they were for us to take. And he goes, no, Dr. Campbell, he goes, the president would like you to ride with him in the motorcade. I'm like, oh, of course, yes. That's a true story.
That's so great. Well, It's I think it's a great personal triumph, really. And it's nice the president
gathered some of those things up, put those back in, walking down. Yeah.
No, that's great. So we have to conclude with just a couple of comments about this meeting that's going on up the road between the two presidents, President Xi Jinping and President Obama. And, I think expectations are high, probably too high for what can be accomplished, but it is a completely novel approach that has really never been tried. Even back with Mao and Nixon, they didn't spend as much time together. So what do you think is likely to come out of this? What do you hope? If you were President Obama, what would you be saying to President Xi?
Yeah, thanks. First of all, we helped on this idea of an informal meeting in last year. We really said this is the right way to go. A lot of suspicions, a lot of anxieties about whether this was appropriate. You know, I think there were a lot of worries that this may harken back to the kinds of meetings that took place between the United States and the Soviet Union. Remember when Gorbachev and Reagan met at Reykjavik and the like. But in the end, I think everyone saw the advantages. And there was a need at the beginning of President Obama's second term and the beginning of Xi Jinping's term as president to meet early in their tenures to establish a relationship, which you really can't do very easily in a meeting around a multilateral forum. Those meetings are rushed. And guys, the meetings that we have really to date, that Susan and I have been involved in, I've been in a ton of them now, these state visits are highly formulaic, extremely heavy on protocol and face, and it's almost like playing a role in a play that you all have your, like, there are society weddings that are less choreographed, right? Balanchine ballets that are, you know, more spontaneous. So it got to the place that the risks were high. Little things that could go wrong would cause potential problems. But finally, it was actually the Chinese that came to us and said, look, why don't we try this? Which I think is a tremendous sign of maturity and a recognition of the need for this kind of dialogue. We initially thought about it in Europe, but I think it's even better to do it here in the United States. I think it is closer. I agree with Susan. It's nothing of modern experience is comparable, but I do think it is more similar to the kinds of unplanned, you know, kind of Mao or Chou En-lai dropping in the guest house just for a conversation. So it's more like that. I think in all likelihood, the two leaders will begin by reviewing the progress to date, what's been accomplished. They'll also go over some of the challenges and some of the opportunities. But I think more than anything else that it will likely be philosophical. I think there will be some philosophical discussions. I hope there will be. That's what there was. That was what it was like between Vice President Biden and then Vice President Xi Jinping. And so I think they will have some of that in the interactions. It's a very small group. I mean, there's too much has been made of the, you know, open collar. The irony is, you know, the way Asian diplomacy with the United States works is when people say casual open collar, which we do sometimes in meetings, everyone then comes to the meeting dressed exactly the same with the same buttons unbuttoned. So the whole quality of meaning to be informal is it's really formalized informality. So there'll probably be a little bit of that when the two sides get together. I think what can be expected is I believe we will be able to dispel some anxieties about what we're about. I think the Chinese will be better at raising some concerns that they have about the United States, and it will force us to be clear in our own minds about what our goals and ambitions are. So I think Chinese friends will say, tell us about why so many military activities close to our borders is helping our relationship. And I think we'll have to talk about that a little bit more clearly than perhaps we've had in the past. I think the United States will ask China, like, these cyber attacks against American businesses can't be good, can it, when American businesses are the ballast in the U.S.-China relationship. So I think it will help both countries to see a little bit from each other's perspectives. But I would see it not as an end point, but simply the very initial steps on a long journey. What I think is most hopeful, everyone has their own U.S.-China experience. Everyone does. For me, I mentioned at an earlier session, was the darkest hour for me during the discussions about the fate of a blind dissident, where I sat quietly in a room with my counterpart, and he and I both realized that it was imperative that we had to find a way out of this, right? And despite the tensions and the difficulties.
Chen Guangcheng. Despite, when you were there for quite a few days.
Yeah, just forever and no sleeping. But I knew my counterparts sought a similar outcome, that we needed to find a way out. And that for me has given me enormous confidence going forward. And my hope is that the two teams will find a similar sort of confidence about that despite our challenges, that any tensions basically are held within a larger containment of a recognition of needing to work together.
Don't use that word.
Which one?
Containment.
Oh, container, I said.
Oh, so, container.
Container. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Sorry, didn't mean to. Didn't mean to. I'll pivot away from that. So I think generally speaking, the fact that the Chinese came to us and said we're prepared for this kind of meeting is terrific.
But
I agree very much with Susan. Let's not set unrealistic expectations. And I will also tell you, it is natural that there are tensions between the United States and China. Natural and to be expected. And I sometimes find that I will sit with the early architects of the U.S.-China relations, and they kind of look down at you and they tisk-tisk you about, gee, you know, we did it so much better 40 years ago. But the truth is, the strategies and the steps that you apply when you're trying to engage a country that is essentially isolated from the world, that is at the earliest stages of development, the strategies that you apply then and the strategies that you apply now to the most rapidly rising country in the history of the planet are just night and day. And there are going to be tensions in our relationship, and that's the way it should be. And if there aren't, you're not doing your job.
That is a really good point. And why don't we say thank you now for coming to visit IOPS and join us in this conversation. So thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.